Good morning and welcome to Holden Village. Today is Tuesday, September 4th, 2001. In the fireside room this morning is Peter Drury. Today's session number is DRP 2001-02, and it's titled, I Have Redeemed You. Let's listen in.
And I'll say that my name is Peter Drury, and this is session number 2 of Bible study at Holden Village on Isaiah 43. And I'd like us to open up with prayer together, shall we? Gracious God, always abundant in your love for us, your hope for our future, your mercy on our path. We come today to you seeking to learn new things in your word, aspects of your story in our story, and how it may shower down upon us, both to refresh us, but also to nurture new growth and new life in our path. In the name of the risen one, we pray. Amen. Welcome. Come on in. And if anybody didn't grab a Bible, those are from investors. The Bibles are over here, and those are LBWs and Wisdom of Voice. Did anybody, before we get going, anybody not have a Bible? We have plenty of them over here. We can pass a few more around. I will say you'll have to forgive this prideful voice, but at Seattle First Christian Church in downtown Seattle, we do a cooperative ecumenical vacation Bible school together with our ELCA neighbor, Central Lutheran Church in Seattle. And in our church, we didn't have a Sunday school for about 30 years, which probably meant we didn't have VBS for about 40. I don't really know. But so we got going on a cooperative vacation Bible school. This was our second year in a row this year, and it's a really successful program. And for a couple of urban churches with smaller numbers of kids, it's been neat to work together. But what I enjoyed this year was, you know, the second time around of anything, you always get to look back and remember what happened the time before. The first time, everything's new. But then the second time around, people have their memories of last year. And something that the Lutherans remembered about the year before that I didn't notice at all was that by the second year around, they got the Lutheran kids to come to VBS with their Bibles. They said the year before, the kids from First Christian Church showed up with Bibles in hand for VBS, and the kids from Central Lutheran Church just arrived, and then maybe with their lunches or something. So they said, well, it took them a year of training, but they got their kids to come with Bibles the second year around. So I enjoyed that. That was a proud moment for our church. You know, for a teeny weeny beany little church in a little urban center, I thought, hey, we got it right. We did something all right. Well, today we're going to look at another phrase in Isaiah 43, the beginning part. And I think as I look around, I think most of you were here yesterday. I'm not sure if I see, I mean, maybe a couple of new faces, but mostly you were here. So I'm not going to cover too much of that material from yesterday, but I want to just make sure that we're on the same page, that we are in Isaiah 43, and in Isaiah 40 began what we call Second Isaiah. Okay, so First Isaiah is chapters 1 through 39, and that's from the pre-exilic period. That's when the Israelites are still in and around Jerusalem. And then beginning in chapter 40, after about 160 years between chapter 39 and chapter 40, you have a community in exile. Hence, and if you understand that and you read the whole book start to finish, that'll make a lot of sense to you. You have a community in exile now between chapters 40 and 55. And then in the last 10, in 56 from 66, you have the post-exilic community. That's once they're returning home. So you really have this prophetic tradition of Isaiah lasting over three very, very different periods in the history of Israel. And I would add to that to say that I think a lot of times, you buy a book in the store today and you look and you see who the author is and you think, okay, well, this book is by that author. And it might be disconcerting to you to think that maybe they aren't the only author, maybe someone else helped out on that. Well, in the tradition of prophecy in ancient Israel, and also in the tradition of early Christianity with the letters of Paul, it was not uncommon, for example, in the letters of Paul, for Paul, for example, to write a letter or a series of letters, and then for disciples of Paul, who were well-schooled in his teaching, to write letters on his behalf. And so some people get worried about the integrity of the Bible, and they say, oh gosh, if we're trying to figure out, you know, if Paul really, you know, literally with his hand wrote each of those letters, or if someone says to us, oh, Ephesians probably wasn't written by Paul, it was probably written by someone in, you know, in Paul's school. Some people get really scared that we're messing with their Bible. But I would just say that at the time, that didn't bother anybody. I mean, that was a part of convention. And so to talk about three periods of Isaiah is really consistent with the prophetic tradition of Israel. I'll tell you, if there's one way to talk, I mean, if you want to mess with a prophetic tradition, it's not to suggest that there are three different Isaiahs, in a sense, or three different periods of Isaiah's prophecy. If you want to mess with the prophetic tradition in ancient Israel, that's to suggest that they do not stand in the line of Moses. That would be talking about compromising the integrity of the prophetic tradition in Israel. There's a whole standard of Moses as prophet for the people Israel. And if you, it's not the subject of our study here, but you can find whole books in the library. I haven't looked in this one, but certainly in any theological library, that talk about the Mosaic standard of prophecy and the great pains that each of the prophets go to in their own writings to show that they stand in line with the principles of Moses. They really had to, in a sense, justify themselves as sub-prophets of Moses. And you'll find that. You can go through in Jeremiah and Isaiah and Ezekiel and even in the minor prophets and find the aspects, for example, in their call narrative where they need to, I mean, just the fact that the call narratives are in there. If you think about that with all the prophets, the fact of the call narrative, that's very important because Moses had a call narrative, a very compelling call narrative. What did that involve? Moses' call narrative. A burning bush, right? Some other things as well. Well, the call narrative tradition is one of those. There's 5, 6, 7 aspects to the authenticity of a Mosaic prophet. So today, some people might be concerned, what? You're talking about three Isaiahs? And I just say, well, it's kind of like talking about 1st and 2nd Corinthians. You know, I mean, they're different periods of time, different aspects to understanding the context for this writing. So we're in Isaiah 43. And this is a community which never thought it would be in exile. I mean, they had their Exodus experience, and they thought that was behind them, right? And now they're in Babylon, and Babylon is a new kind of Canaan. In fact, and to appropriate the terms from yesterday of text and context, Martin Luther is famous for appropriating Babylon as a metaphor to something else. Who knows what Martin Luther considered to be Babylon?
Captivity under the Pope.
Yeah, exactly right. Exactly right. So Roman Catholicism was Martin Luther's Babylon, and so he wrote about issues of being exiled and needing atonement or redemption or restoration. Okay, so these terms get used around in a lot of places, and you can look, for example, another great example of that. This happens more with the Exodus than with Babylon, but certainly with both of them, is you look at the tradition of African-American preaching in North America, and you look at the appeal to the prophets prophesying in the exile in Babylon, or the person of Moses and the freedom from, you know, the release from slavery to freedom. Again, where a particular context appeals back to scriptures written in a certain text that then come into a new context and then take on a new shape, a shape with integrity for sure. I mean, absolutely with integrity, but there's a new context. And so to use the word from yesterday of text as fabric and context as a joining together of fabric, there are new ways in which these stories become conjoined. So today we're looking at really the term redemption, the phrase, I have redeemed you. Let's pull out our Bibles and let's just read this section again, Isaiah 43. And, I need to get my door prizes ready. Need to get some door prizes, so I'm hiding them. No one knows what they are. So I need somebody to volunteer to read Isaiah 43. It's 1, 2, and I call it 3A, the first half of the third verse. Who would like to read that? Can't be someone who got a door prize yesterday.
Oh, darn.
Yeah, I know. Charles was ready for number two. He was going to go hawk him or something. No, I'm kidding. Okay, go. And I'm sorry, in the light, I can't. Your name is?
Orpha.
You're Orpha. Okay, great to see you. And I'm going to give you your door prize here. Just let's pass it in the door.
Thanks.
You're welcome.
But now thus says the Lord, he who created you, O Jacob, he who formed you, O Israel, do not fear, for I have redeemed you. I have called you by name. You are mine. When you pass through the waters, I will be with you, and through the rivers, they shall not overwhelm you. And when you walk through fire, you shall not be burned, and the flame shall not consume you. For I am the Lord your God, the Holy One of Israel, your Savior.
Thank you. So to start to learn about what this redemption is about, let's look at that phrase. What is it preceded by in the text? The sentence isn't just, I have redeemed you. What does it say? What's immediately before it?
Do not fear,
for I have redeemed you. So it's a cause for not fearing, right? I mean, even, let's just say we're going to go on a little word exploration and try to figure out what redemption means. And this is a little different than S&H green stamps, which you redeem at a redemption center, right? This isn't, now there may be an etymological connection between redeeming your S&H green stamps, right, at a redemption center. I think that's an interesting, in fact, there's a great poem, I wish I could remember now, African-American poet who wrote a powerful story about, poem called, I think the title is Jesus Saves. If not, it's kind of the theme. And in the end, he raises kind of the irony of Jesus saves, Jesus saves, Jesus saves. And the last line is S&H green stamps. But you have to read the whole poem to get the larger. But he's mocking in popular and dominant culture in the 60s around issues of salvation and redemption and freedom, and he plays with that in the poem. And so the culminating line, I mean, it sounds awful. That's all I remember, unfortunately, and I need to. I'm taking the text out of context. Thank you. And I'm trying. That's right. So if you track down that poem at some point, you know, just let me know, because I read that once and I forget who that was. But if we're going to go on a little word exploration and try to figure out what redemption is, we know for starters from the text that it was something that should cause us not to fear, which also means that we must have been fearing, right? I mean, let's just go with what we have for a second. So we can assume that someone is in fear and someone else is saying, here's a cause not to fear, for there is redemption. Okay, that's what we know in the text. Now, redeeming in English is kind of a curious word, and it seems typically to be a kind of a financial term, and that actually has great deep connections to the Hebrew root. But just someone tell me, when we use the word redeem in English, let's say even outside of a church context, just, you know, forget it as a sacred term, when do you use the word redeem in English today?
Okay,
coupon, you're going to get something back.
Redeem a bond.
Redeem a bond?
Yes.
Okay.
To give up.
I'm sorry, what's that?
To give up, to redeem you.
To an act for which you get something in return.
An act for which you get something in return?
Mm-hmm.
An exchange. Okay. Well, that has, it's a little shifted in context, and I think that sometimes, every once in a while, I'll hear, I'm not much of a TV watcher. I tend to turn on the TV when I want to follow the Mariners. Other than that, I'm not really a TV watcher. But every once in a while, you'll kind of be futzing for the right channel, and you come across a televangelist, and boy, the word redeem gets a lot of, you know, gets a lot of airtime, and sometimes it sounds a lot more like a coupon. To me, and to my ears, and it's interesting. I really want to make this point. This is not necessarily criticism of them, but I think that because of that, a lot of us think that the term redeem is mostly a New Testament term. If I were to just ask you, I'll give you the answer ahead of time. I'm going to tell you it's in the Hebrew Bible, but let me just ask you. Be honest with me. If I had said walking into class today, the word redeem, does that happen mostly in the New Testament or the Old Testament? Who would say New Testament? Just if you were just guessing.
Because that's what Christ is.
Yeah. Redeem as a word has very little play in the New Testament. It has very much play. Has very much play in the Psalms and in 2 Isaiah. In fact, there's an interesting discussion of the fact that if it weren't for Luther's interest in the word redeem, it would probably not have half the airtime even today than it does as a New Testament church, which is an interesting concept. Now that makes us say, and especially when looking here in Isaiah, we're talking about a context not only in Babylonian exile, we're also talking about a context a good 600 years before this Jesus character is wandering around on earth. So don't rush to think that redemption here, I mean, we just kind of pull this out of its context and say, oh, that's about my Lord and Savior or something. I mean, this isn't talking about that, is it? Now, I'm not dismissing Christ as redemptive. I'm not dismissing that at all. I'm just interested in what the text really says. It's written to a community of people in Israel who've never heard of a character called Jesus and won't for a very long time. They had a faith story about restoration and a land of promise, a land flowing with milk and honey. And then they got uprooted from that. And there was a plot twist. That's what we were talking about yesterday. There was a big darn plot twist. So our goal today, perhaps, is to uncover what is redemption about in the period of 2nd Isaiah. I had an experience recently. I spent a bit of time, I have to be careful how I say this, I spent a bit of time in the King County Jail. I do spend
it. Most of us have.
That's right. That's right. I do spend a bit of time in the King County Jail, and there was a gentleman recently in our congregation, and it was an interesting experience because I kept trying to go see him at the jail, and I kept getting there, and the allowable hours that I could go see him kept shifting. And I've learned over time, actually, that that's it's pretty normal. I would go in, let's say, on a Sunday after church, I'd drop by and I'd say, what are the hours this week? And he'd say, okay, Tuesday between 1 and 3 and Thursday between 8 a.m. and 10 or something. And that's just for him. I mean, it was different for each person in the jail. So I might show up at Tuesday between 1 and 3 and they say, oh, well, he's Wednesday from 1 to 5. And, you know. And so I was getting kind of frustrated with that over a period of months. And it's the kind of thing, you know, as a busy pastor, it's the kind of thing that makes you then wind up not getting down to the jail. You know, it just takes one or two of those experiences, because by the time you get down there and you find parking for your car and you gotta leave all your stuff behind because you can't have any keys, and well, what do I do with my keys because I'm gonna need them to get back into my car? And then you get there and you can't go see him. So it took a couple of times, and I'm embarrassed to say I kind of started giving up on the task. It just made it lower and lower and lower on the ring of priorities. And every once in a while I would talk to this guy's dad on the phone, and he and his father were not terribly close in the past, but because of present troubles in this guy's life, there was a lot more support there, and I think his dad was really concerned for him being in jail, and so his dad really, you know, he'd call me from time to time, hey, have you seen my son yet? And I just kept feeling more and more guilty, and I'd go on down, and so finally I called the chaplain at the jail, which there isn't really officially a chaplain at the jail, but there's someone who's kind of connected to the United Methodist Church kind of nearby that kind of can approve the folks, that can kind of have a credential, that can kind of, I mean, there's just all kinds of, and for understandable reasons, there's all kinds of red tape. And I understand that, because a lot of people feel like their mission is to go convert prisoners. And if you're the administrator of a jail, and no kidding, I mean, in a city like Seattle, if 500 different people come to you and you're the administrator at the jail and all these people want to convert to their, and they want to have programs, I mean, it really could be a huge headache. I really understand that. But so I finally figured out how to be diligent about the process. And I would say a good 9 or 10, 11 months after my first attempt to get there, I finally sat in an orientation class, and I took a half-day training on an orientation to the King County Jail. And the benefit being that at the end of that orientation class, I could have a little name tag that I could clip to my person when I went in, and I could go see a parishioner at any time of day. I mean, within some reason, I think between 8 a.m. and 10 p.m. I mean, you know, rational hours. I couldn't go at 3 in the morning. And one of the things that they taught me when I went to the jail was there are very good reasons for those hours shifting. You know, I used to be someone who thought, oh, golly, they changed the hours from Tuesdays at 1 to Wednesdays at 3. And I learned that, you know, hey, riots happen at the jail and they have to lock down a floor, that kind of thing, or they have to move people around. And I learned in the orientation class, look, it's, you know, if you arrive and they tell you the hours are different, you know, before you just chew out the security guard in front of you, think for a second about the stressors of their day. And so in the orientation, they talk to us about what these folks are dealing with. And I learned an awful lot in that process. Well, they gave us, at the culmination of this, a tour of the jail. And the King County Jail is 10 or 11 stories high. And I learned what was kind of on the first floor and the second floor and the third floor, and where the medical wing was on the fifth floor and the psychiatric wing on the sixth. And then as you went higher and higher and higher in the jail, it's because folks are in there for increasingly serious offenses. And I also learned what colors, this was a great thing, actually, what colors they wear in relation to felonies or not.
Exactly.
Because then when you know about that.
Yeah. So, yeah. Sad to say, I wore one of those colors.
Okay. Okay. Well, I'm glad that you're here. And on this side of the... Well, I learned a little bit about the colors, and that made a little difference when I was talking to someone in the jail, maybe a prisoner, who was telling me that they were just in there for a minor something, and they were in that kind of rusty red color that said felony right at me. And so that was just kind of interesting information to have. But as they took us on this tour through the jail, there was a section... I've forgotten. How many of you have either toured a jail or been in a jail? I mean, that's fair. Been on the inside, known someone in jail. You have a sense of, you go through different hallways. Every time there's a door, every time there's a passage, like here at Koinonia, you've got these double doors, right? Because you have to get inside the door, they lock it behind you. And then you go through the next one, they lock that, right? And so there's this very complex network of how the jail is even structured. There came a point in our tour, I don't remember where we were going to or from, and it's easy to lose orientation in there because you're just spinning around in all these different directions. But we wound up in one of these kind of holding rooms between hallways, and we had to wait because something had come up in the jail. And so there's a group, this orientation was maybe 12 of us, mostly pastors and lay ministers. We just had to wait there. Well, we wound up face-to-face with a kind of equivalent holding space for inmates on the other side. And there might have been 12 or 15 of them. So we're kind of in this space. And a lot of things were said, but there's one that I remember especially. And it'll probably haunt me. This will be one of those things that'll just kind of haunt me all of my life, and I wish I could just let go of it. But I remember, and it must have been to look at us, to look at those of us touring the jail. I don't know, but I'm guessing folks were looking around and trying to not look inmates in the face. I don't know. Maybe not. I mean, you don't want to just be staring at us. I mean, it was a very awkward situation. And what I remember is an inmate just saying, "Don't look, don't look, you may be next. Don't look, you'll be next." And, and inside of myself, even though I know, I don't tend to rob banks and steal cars and do crack cocaine I don't expect to find myself in that world. But standing in that space and hearing someone say to me, don't look, you may be next. And I thought that in a certain sense, they were absolutely right. I mean, he was saying, don't make assumptions. Don't think that you're the good guy and we're the bad guy. But that voice it's amazing the power that had over me as I stood there and as we went through the rest of the jail tour. I mean, it really filled me with a sense of fear that was really not of my own making. It wasn't something that I had kind of taken in there with me. I was feeling pretty comfortable touring the jail. And it just was can you feel that with me? I mean, it really shook me up. Well, his words caused in me a fear that really wasn't real or wasn't based on reality. And he reframed my experience in a way that I began to have the illusion of a reality that caused me to fear. Let me say that again. His words caused me to perceive an illusion of reality, which in turn caused me to fear. And now that I'm up at Holden, and that was months ago, I mean, I'm not saying that every day I wake up and think, oh no, am I going to wake up and see myself robbing a bank? But in that moment, and really for the rest of that week, to be honest, I mean, it just kind of grated at me internally. And I want to say, darn you, don't say that, but I respect why he said it. I'm sure that there's, I mean, boy, those tensions between who's passing by freely on the outside and who's on the inside.
Did one of the prisoners say this?
Or yeah. Yeah, not the guard. No, prisoner did. And in a very strong, in my voice, I can't even begin to give you the, I mean, it was a very forceful voice.
It's a stressful moment for both.
Mm-hmm, absolutely.
Because prisoners, when they have tourist prisoners feel like, animals feel like in a zoo.
Yeah. Absolutely.
Because we're stuck behind this plexiglass.
Right.
And we're climbing up and down our bunks and stuff like that and everything. You can see everything that a prisoner does. There's nothing left to the imagination. Absolutely nothing.
Right. Charles, and if you hadn't said that, I was just about to say that it had the sense of a zoo. I mean, you have a sense of kind of caged animals. There's no privacy, no dignity. I mean, all of that. So.
You know, they say things that they will haunt you.
So I'm gonna move on from that now. But thank you. I really appreciate your sharing that. Mm-hmm. So there is an illusion of a reality that leads to fear. And this is the perfect moment for me then to tell you about what the meaning of prophecy was in ancient Israel, because a lot of people think. Just like if I'd asked you if you thought redeem was in the New Testament rather than the Old Testament. Mm-hmm. A lot of people think prophet's job was to foretell the future. Okay, be honest. Who thinks the prophet's job is to foretell the future? A job of a prophet sometimes might entail foretelling the future. That's the fine print on the job description. Primarily the prophets in the history of Israel were to address the future through their reading of the present by giving some kind of a reframing of the present reality consistent with the history of the tradition. Are you with me? Prophets talked a lot about the future, but this idea of them being primarily magicians or fortune tellers or future seers, I mean, it's there a little bit of the time, but I think we miss the understanding of prophecy. What we're talking about now is in 2nd Isaiah, you're talking about whoever the 2nd Isaiah is, addressing a community who is in a situation in which 2nd Isaiah is saying, you have an illusion of reality upon which you have based a fear. And for that reason, I want to tell you a different story about the future. Now, do you feel that's a subtle shift, but are you with me on that distinction? That's where we are. So to talk about redemption, so you got to unpack these things to get, I'm still in the same first thought about what is redemption. So now let me tell you what the word is. It's not, I mean, redeem is an English word, right? The word in Hebrew, ga'al, is a legal word. And it's a legal word that does pertain to economics, but it's primarily a legal word. And it is from within family law in ancient Israel. Family law. So think about the person who wrote your will or talked to you about your estate or, you know. I mean, it's that crowd of legal terms. And it is the term that pertains to a variety of circumstances. Probably the most common was if a member of your family fell into indentured servitude, there was a way that you could make payment to free them of that obligation. There is also, under the very same word and the same legal category, there was an issue that dealt with a goring ox. If you owned a goring ox in ancient Israel, and your goring ox killed somebody else, do you know what your penalty would be?
Death.
Okay. And so there would be ways where extended family members could pay an immense amount to the other family, the survivor of the one who had died, for you to be goel, to be redeemed, to be reconciled, so that you could maintain your life. So redemption in ancient Israel is a term for freedom from an obligation, a serious obligation, I mean, that starts your world anew, let's just say. That's what that term in Hebrew is. Interesting thing is it's also used a lot, it's basically the same thing as atonement, which every once in a while you hear somebody say, well, atonement, that's at-one-ment. And I used to think that was just a cute thing, but that's actually, etymologically, that's the history. Atonement is at-one-ment, and that term was becoming popular in late 16th century, and who knows when the King James Bible was translated? Who knows when the King James Version was translated?
1633.
Okay. I think it was 1611. Was it 1633? But early, yeah, I was 16. But you can scour your King James. I think this is true. In the Oxford English Dictionary, it tells me that somewhere the term atonement as a single word around 1550 became a word. The OED is amazing, by the way. If you ever look, you can how they can track the origins of words. But they say about 1550. And they said that in 1611, it was considered too new of a phrase to be included in the Bible. This is interesting. You can find the word, apparently, atone. I haven't gone and searched it in King James. Apparently, atone is in there. But atonement was kind of a newfangled, it was not dignified enough to work its way into the Bible in 1611. I just think that's kind of interesting. So we are talking here about, in redemption, going from an obligation to freedom. We're talking about atonement, which sometimes, I mean, that's an easier thing to think about, is truly being at one, truly being whole. Another good word that we use for this today is reconciliation. And we use reconciliation sometimes kind of like we do with redemption today. I mean, you reconcile your bank statement. Or you don't. Some of you don't reconcile them. But you reconcile the books, right? So those are kind of economic terms, very similar biblical terms. I would suggest that 2 Isaiah is primarily talking about a topic of homecoming. And this isn't homecoming parades and homecoming floats. But 2 Isaiah is primarily interested in talking about homecoming. And I'll invite you, as I did yesterday and as I will the rest of this week, as we think about these themes, to think not only of them in their historical context, but to think of your own context and maybe the ways in which you may be feeling a need to go home or to be at home, or ways in which it's too scary to go home and you can't go home. Just if those are, you know, realities in your imagination, I'd include and encourage you to kind of lift those up as we're thinking this through today. Friedrich Buechner has a wonderful quote. In fact, I want to write it up on the board. I think this is neat. Let me just take time to write this up. He has a book about homecoming. Who knows Friedrich Buechner? It's Buechner. Just delightful writer. Anything of it is just fabulous, wonderful. And really lighthearted. He has these books like The Alphabet of Grace and Peculiar Treasures. He has kind of an alphabet of biblical figures and has these wonderful descriptions of them. So just food for thought. Here's what Buechner says about home. And this is where I want us to go here with the rest of this session. Is that dark enough?
No, it's not.
Let me see if I can. Well, maybe if I do sideways. Well, you know what? Let me try one other, and I may just wind up reading it to you. I wanted you to visualize it, but let's see.
That's better. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. Okay. Now I'll erase both of them and start up. Here's Buechner's quote. In fact, while I'm doing this, let me give you a little internal homework. We talked yesterday about comfort. We read in the Lamentations about how there was no one to comfort, and then 2 Isaiah started with comfort, comfort, O my people. Think for a moment about your comfort food, or your comfortable clothes, or in what situations you feel most comfortable. Just think about that while I'm writing this. Comfort food, comfortable clothes, or situations when you feel most comfortable. Thank you. Buechner says, no matter how much the world shatters us to pieces, we carry inside us a vision of wholeness that we sense is our true home and that beckons us. Let's say that again. No matter how much the world shatters us to pieces, we carry inside us a vision of wholeness that we sense is our true home and that beckons us. And that's in his book, The Longing for Home. Second Isaiah is interested in homecoming. Homecoming. And the work of redemption, the work of atonement, the work of reconciliation is bringing us back to our true home, our true selves. It's bringing us back to a knowledge of truth that transcends our fears and consequently a cause for us not to fear. It makes me think of the passage in the Gospels that says, you shall know the truth and the truth shall make you free. You shall know the truth and the truth shall make you free. That's Isaiah's task as a prophet, is not foretelling the future, but reminding Israel through their history what is true about their present and how that in turn affects their future. Prophecy is an amazing role. Prophecy is a very powerful role. And 2 Isaiah is interested in homecoming. Well, you're thinking about comfortable foods and comfortable clothes and situations in which you're comfortable. So now you have those nice settling thoughts about mashed potatoes and gravy or corn on the cob or whatever that is. I was speaking with some folks yesterday who were here in this room who were talking about refugees from the Sudan and their church hosting them. Think now for anything you know about refugees. Maybe you've been a refugee, or maybe you've known of a refugee, or maybe you just during the Bosnian, you know, crisis, maybe you were aware of refugees or something. Think about anything you know about refugees. What comes to mind about refugees? I mean, is that a comfortable...
They're displaced.
Okay, displacement for sure. What's the nature of, I mean, for folks who are refugees, what's that existence like?
I would say agony.
Agony.
The loss of everything comfortable.
Loss of everything comfortable.
They long to go home.
Long to go home.
They tend to band together.
Tend to band together. Maybe the only resource they have is each other. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
They've been terrorized and they're afraid to go home.
Been terrorized, yes, absolutely, thank you. Terrorized and afraid, and absolutely. Yeah, longing to go home, but being terrorized so that they can't, or it would be worse to go home. So it's one thing for us to think about this text in terms of our own lives and say, aha, I have times when I feel displaced, and this will make you. I mean, you're talking about a refugee community. And Isaiah trying to call it like he sees it, being a little bit of the umpire, and saying, look, folks, God is with you. Thus says the Lord, I have redeemed you. Do not fear. I have called you by name, and you are mine. And as we observed yesterday, none of that's really new information, ostensibly. But it's new information in this context. New information in this context. One of the most wonderful examples of reconciliation or atonement or of a certain kind of homecoming that I've observed was some years ago, early in the AIDS crisis, when I was helping out in an organization that was assisting people with AIDS, and one of my roles involved being in a house where there were six men living with AIDS. This was in the late 80s. Oh, go ahead. This is in the late 1980s. And in this house, people would wind up referred into this house to have affordable housing in an intentional community as people who were living with AIDS. They weren't at a point of dying. If that happened, they would wind up in the hospital, or they would have a hospice person come and be a part of their experience. This was a place for living with AIDS. But these were not six housemates who chose each other. You know, they didn't say, hey, we're all old buddies from college, let's get a house together, right? Oh, I grew up with you, let's be, you know, housemates. These were six folks who were meeting each other for this, you know, for only one reason, because they were each living with the same illness, which, I mean, today, the prognosis is bad enough, but certainly 10 years ago, it was even more dire in a lot of ways. Especially because of medications at the time. I mean, alterations have happened now with medications, so people are living longer, and the medications are, you know, causing less catastrophe on people, that kind of thing. Well, there were two gentlemen in this house, one of them named Tom and one of them named James. Tom was Caucasian, gay, and deaf. James was African-American and a drug addict who would want nothing to do with anybody in the gay community. Tom, white, gay, deaf. James, black, drug addict, wants nothing to do with gay people or the stigma that comes with AIDS at all. Now, these were two, both actually perfectly nice guys. I mean, if you talk to them individually, with Tom, obviously, was with sign language, and I was learning a little bit of that at the time. Both perfectly nice guys. But to be in the room at the same time, let's just say there wasn't a real warm, fuzzy relationship. And the fact that they had been invited to be housemates together because they both have this diagnosis, I mean, that's just not a great basis for friendship, right? I mean, oh, look what we have in common, right? I remember a day when I was sitting on the porch outside. It was a hot day, probably about this time of year, I would imagine. Might have been August, might have been July. And as I say, I was just learning a little bit of sign language, and I mostly was frustrated in what I didn't know, although I actually was taking it because of him when I realized early in my internship with that organization that I would be dealing with people who were deaf. I thought, well, you know, let me also during this year of this internship take some sign language classes. So I was learning a little bit, but there was someone else in the organization who knew sign language. She was hard of hearing and she knew sign language very, very well, and so she mostly interpreted the conversations, that kind of thing, in staff and house meetings and such. And Anyway, so we're on the back porch this time of year. It's hot out. And for whatever reasons, I wind up on the back porch with both James and with Tom. I don't know how, I have no recollection of how we all wound up there. I don't think we were all in the living room and we said, hey, let's all go out to the back porch. I mean, somehow we all wound up there. And I was sitting out there with Tom and probably wanting to try out my sign language a little bit, maybe communicating about a little bit, and James and I were probably talking on the other side of the porch. I probably had this two-way thing going on. And there came a time when Tom was signaling to me something, and I couldn't figure out what it was. And I'm kind of looking around, and I'm trying to, I can say, what? That's sign language. What? So he'd do whatever again. Again, couldn't figure it out. And I was just kind of feeling fairly helpless, and gosh, what's he need? But it became increasingly more important. Not really urgent, like tragic, but I mean, but you know, it became increasingly important. And finally, from across the deck, I hear James kind of said something like, he wants ice in his glass. I was like, what? James says, he wants ice for his water. And so I went and I grabbed the glass and I kind of signaled him to get ice and brought it back. And Tom was happy as could be. I mean, that was exactly what he needed, exactly what he wanted. I, for starters, felt better because I was able to respond to the need. But I'll tell you, there was a sacramental quality. There was a sacramental quality to sitting in a shared space with two people for whom I had witnessed kind of ongoing non-communication, and to just this breakthrough statement of, here's his need. Mm-hmm. James telling me about Tom's need, which in turn allowed me to help free up Tom from that need. In a sense, that's what redemption is about in 2 Isaiah. Perhaps we even have needs that we don't know about, or perhaps we have needs that others can't even tell. Who knows? Literally, God only knows. And 2 Isaiah proclaims to the people Israel, do not fear, you who are refugees, in agony, terrorized, in grief. Do not fear, for I have redeemed you. Now I can hardly wait to know what it means when God says, you are mine, and I have called you by name. That's really getting to the good stuff. Go into this day in the grace and peace of Christ. Amen.